court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Resendez versus Johnson, and we're very pleased to welcome with us today a class from Cassis Elementary School to listen to this argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Mulberg will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. Your Honors, this case involves the alleged arbitrary and capricious punishment of school children at the Comstock Middle School in Dallas, Texas. Our petition, as I'm sure you're aware, presents 2 points. First, the lower court, the appeals court, erred in holding that the plaintiffs have no substantive due process right under the 14th Amendment to be free of unreasonable punishment at the hands of the two respondents.
Can he describe for me briefly the punishment? I mean, what was unreasonable about the punishment?
Well, we never got to the level of the punishment, Your Honor, for this reason. This is very important. I meant to point this out later on. This is a Mitchell versus Forsyth appeal. And the fact that the respondent has said, well, it just wasn't bad enough, they said that on appeal. If you go back and look at the clerk's record, the Mitchell versus Forsyth type of appeal looks only to the allegation as to whether or not you've alleged a deprivation of a recognized constitutional right.
Well, assuming there is a deprivation of, or the possibility of a deprivation of a right in the context of right. Corporal punishment, as you allege and you claim the Court of Appeals was wrong, what was the basis for the summary judgment motion on behalf of these defendants? Wasn't it based on qualified immunity, that their conduct had not risen to the level where there would be a violation and they were therefore immune from the suit?
No, they did not obtain summary judgment. It was the appellate court that reversed the trial.
But their summary judgment, they moved for summary judgment on the grounds of qualified immunity on the federal claim. Right. Or was it on the underlying merits of the claim?
No, it was on, and I want to point this out because this is a very serious misrepresentation, I feel, because in the trial court, and when I say Mitchell versus Forsyth, if you look at the clerk's record at page 112, they admit the law is crystal clear that until the court has ruled on the motion regarding federal immunity, discovery cannot even be had. The whole motion was premised on the Mitchell versus Forsyth. So there were no facts involved in this case, and as you know, the appellate court really looked at none in its two-point analysis.
Well, what were your allegations then? Because surely they have to rise to some level.
To allege under federal law, we have to allege the deprivation of a clearly established constitutional right.
And you have to give some facts to for that allegation.
Well, that's not what this went to, but yes, we do at some point. Now, keep in mind that the heightened pleading requirement has been discarded in many respects. But let me say this, Chief Justice. This was not what this turned on. And the error of the appellate court, of course, was saying that we had not alleged and recognized clearly established constitutional right, which is simply not the law. The right to be free from arbitrary or capricious punishment, corporal punishment, has been the law in every circuit that I know of for years and years. There's no question about this.
Is that law as clear in the Fifth Circuit?
It's very clear in Bank in the Fifth Circuit in a case that I had pointed out to the court that they'd never cited. The Doe versus Taylor case says a school child has a substantive 14th Amendment due process right to be free from arbitrary and capricious invasion of their personal privacy. The Woodward, the Fresno's case established that.
Which includes paddling.
Which includes corporal punishment. Yes.
What's the statute of limitations on that? 20 years or 25 years?
I would think it would result
in. I was just curious about that.
No, I said 2 years. But again, keep in mind, Your Honor, I'm not here dealing with philosophical or political issues about corporal punishment in general. There are some underlying facts here that are certainly egregious, and people lost their jobs on it. But that is not what the appellate court turned on.
Well, let me, on that, in that regard, let's. Are the federal cases saying that corporal punishment is the deprivation of a constitutional right, or do they say that the punishment
at some point could rise to the level of deprivation.
The latter.
So if that's the standard, does that necessarily mean that your allegation can't merely say this was corporal punishment, but your allegation has to demonstrate that the punishment exceeded what otherwise was permissible before you were able to state a claim?
Yes, that's the point, Your Honor. Justice Enoch, that is the point. And her pleadings clearly stated that exact phrase out of every case that's dealt with this.
What is the proper test in terms
the
of
proper
what makes corporate punishment unreasonable?
When it is, let me just read it so I get it right out of the case law. Corporal punishment is a deprivation of substantive due process when it is arbitrary, capricious, or wholly unrelated to the legitimate state goal of maintaining an atmosphere conducive to learning. That is the test. Now,
I require you to state sufficient facts in the pleading to demonstrate that you meet what you say there?
No, I've got to prove that.
But the court couldn't require you, because the threshold of determining whether or not a cause of action exists, could you not be required to allege sufficient fact to determine whether that cause of action exists?
If that were the case, I guess in theory, in the Texas practice, that could arise in the special exception context. But keep in mind the procedural posture, Your Honor, that the attack here was one where I keep saying Mitchell versus Forsyth, and quite clearly the opposition stated that that's what they relied on. Their attack was simply that I did not allege a constitutional violation. And the district court rejected that because our allegation is right out of the case law and meets the standard.
Are you saying then that if you just make that statement that you just read, that's enough to keep you in court?
Yes. Yes.
Without any underlying aspects or any other sub factors to look at?
Perhaps, Justice Baker, if we went on to go on further and done a fact based determination, had discovery about. Now, keep in mind, the respondent in the federal context does not have to actually hit these kids if they are deliberately indifferent to someone else doing so. They can be liable. So there are a whole array of facts that could come out later on that might make that appropriate. So the answer is yes, but not at this time.
So your argument is by that one allegation, you can always meet the threshold question, and you're in court.
You always meet the
so you don't have to make it after the allegation is made. You're not permitted as a court to make any assessment of whether that was unreasonable.
I
have to sit on that definition and just the case goes on.
No, not at all. And I don't want you to misunderstand me here. This is a federal immunity question. In order to overcome the official immunity of the individual, you have to allege a violation of a clearly established constitutional right. Otherwise,
and I'm right. And so the threshold inquiry is, have you alleged a clearly defined constitutional right?
Right.
And your answer is, as long as I make this statement I just read to you, I have already met the threshold and we move on.
In the procedural context of this case. Now, that does not prevent, however, somewhere down the line, I suppose after sufficient discovery, for another motion, a fact-based motion, saying, okay, here are all the facts, and it doesn't rise to a violation of the allegation of this clearly established constitution.
Well, do we have a complete record of what the facts are that led the trial court to make this decision and the court of appeals to look at it?
No, we do not have that factual record. We have a record that says that we essentially clearly alleged a recognized right, the violation of a recognized right. There was an immediate interlocutory appeal, and that's where we are today.
But aren't you have all the information that you need to respond. If your position is correct, if they bring a summary judgment claiming you have failed to raise a constitutional deprivation, and you're saying, well, this is a factual inquiry about what the punishment was that was assessed, then since it was your client's children that were punished, you have that information, so you would file your affidavits demonstrating the punishment that was assessed, and we would have a record because we would accept your facts and the inferences in your favor on this summary judgment record.
And there is some of that in here, I believe. But again, I'm saying the procedural posture, you have to remember that once this appeal was filed, everything was stayed.
Well, I'm not talking about discovery. Your clients had the information. You didn't need anything from the school district to determine how severely punished your child was.
Well,
your child could tell you that.
You're assuming that severity makes a difference at the outset, and it certainly doesn't. The Supreme Court has rejected the application of the Eighth Amendment context, it might. It's like asking, well, how bad was a child molested to determine whether or not there had been an invasion of the substantive due process rights of a child.
Okay, maybe I misunderstood. I thought that it is, in fact, the excessiveness of the punishment in a minor child circumstance that creates the constitutional deprivation.
No, I think it is the reasonableness of the punishment within the context of which it's administered. I don't think you line up students in the cafeteria and beat them routinely every morning just because you want to, or order other children to beat them for you.
Maybe we're misunderstanding. I thought your child could tell you what they thought they were punished for, and your child could tell you what the punishment was. What other facts would you need from the other side to defeat a summary judgment as you envision it should have been handled?
I need to know, for example, what input that the principal in this case had into the design of this particularized policy for this one school to alter the corporal punishment guidelines of the Dallas Independent School District, and why the authority was given to the teacher or the coaches to direct other children in violation of that policy to beat children when they told them to.
But I thought you said this was solely decided on the Mitchell versus Forsyth factors, which was whether or not you had alleged that there was a deprivation of constitutional rights.
That's precisely what I said.
What the principal knew or didn't know has nothing. It has to do with the nature of the punishment that was imposed.
And by the same token, what the punishment imposed was in the Mitchell versus Forsyth context, given the allegation, really doesn't have anything to do with it either. In the posture that this case is in,
Mr. Mulberg, you have mentioned several times the word beating, and I'm curious. Because you have, and you said earlier we shouldn't get into the facts of the scope of the corporal punishment. But
right.
Were these beatings?
Well, I contend, or we contend, once we get there, they were. I think that any time that you line school children up in the morning and run them through the cafeteria as a matter of routine and subject them to whatever you want to call it, corporal punishment, and it becomes just a routinized act. I can't consider that anything but that, Your Honor. And when you particularly take a child and direct other children to hit that child, I don't think that is what I consider, having raised four children and had a swift stick of my own at times, reasonable corporal punishment.
You do believe that there can be corporal punishment that is reasonable and constitutional?
Under the constitutional standard, I agree.
With respect to the particular defendants, Johnson and Woolery,
right.
Did they file special exceptions to gain the
plaintiffs? I do not recall that they did. If they did, I don't believe that they were ever heard.
But the allegations, as I read them in the Third Amendment petition, don't particularly focus. Don't allege that either Johnson or Woolery directed children to hit one another or that they engage in excessive corporal punishment.
Well, Your Honor, under Section 1983, they need not have done that. And I believe that's what I was inarticulately trying to point out. If they were aware of it and were consciously indifferent to it, that in itself would give rise to liability on their part. If I could make one or two quick points that I think is a serious problem in this opinion, and it's really a little bit off of what we've been talking about. We have a Fifth Court of Appeals that is engrafted. Here's the real error of this. We ought to go back and start it the right way. The real error here is that they've engrafted a procedural due process component onto substantive due process. They said that because the state has post-deprivation remedies, then there is no substantive right under the Constitution for my clients. That is not the law. In a substantive challenge that is constitutionally based, it doesn't matter what process precedes, accompanies, or follows the action. They did not cite the cases that I cited to them out of the U.S. Supreme Court or the Fifth Circuit directly on point. Nor was the opinion reconsidered. So I don't know how else to say. We have this oddball opinion sitting out here that regardless of your decision on what you've been asking me about, I'm asking you to fix that because it is so strange.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Eichelbaum will present arguments for the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Eichelbaum, tell us about procedurally how the immunity question was raised on the federal claim.
On the federal claim? There was an immunity issue, and it's clearly established right under Harlow that these individuals had, and because they were denied their immunity, we were entitled to an immediate appeal.
Well, this was a motion for summary judgment based on immunity for
yes,
the 1983 claim?
Yes, and that's one
and
of
was the... Was it based on the merits?
Yes, it
whether
was.
Whether or not there was a claim, or was it based on a threshold inquiry about whether or not the pleadings rose to a level that would have alleged a constitutional violation?
It's a very fair question. And the truth is, it was both. We brought it under both allegations. We brought it under the merits. And if you look at the record, page 157.
On the merits of the immunity defense or on the merits of the alleged 1983 claim?
On the alleged 1983 claim.
So you were denied a summary judgment in the trial court on the merits of the 1983 claim?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then how did that get up on appeal, on an interlocutory appeal? Since the denial of a summary judgment on the merits is not subject to review on appeal.
Because they were entitled to immunity, Your Honor. The immunity is something that can be appealed.
Well, I understand that, but that's why I was trying to distinguish whether or not the grounds for your summary judgment
the defense was immunity.
Were immunity grounds, or whether or not your briefing reads like you talk about there were two licks, and two licks don't rise to the level of being unreasonable and arbitrary. And so your brief reads like you were going to the underlying factual inquiry on whether or not this particular conduct did rise to the level of a substantive due process violation that could give rise to a 1983 claim. Is that what your summary judgment did?
It's both, Your Honor, and I apologize if I was misleading. What we said was they're entitled to immunity because the allegations, and we even brought forth evidence, and they had the opportunity and did bring forth evidence to show whether or not the immunity was pierced, whether it was clearly established. And what really happened was the Court of Appeals looked at, let's look at the other cases, and based upon these facts, was there a clearly established right at that time?
Let me make sure. Let's clear this up. Did you move based solely on their petition, or did you also move on the facts that have been brought out in discovery?
We did both, Your Honor. We waited until after discovery was in, and we included facts in our motion.
And he agreed, Mr. Mulberg, that he merely had to have the proper allegations in order to prevail?
No, for a different reason, Your Honor. And I cited in my brief, Angel versus Fairfield, City of Fairfield. In that case, Supreme Court case, they said you must allege facts, not conclusions. If you look at his petition, all he ever does is allude, say, conclusions. There was beatings. There was systematic this. There was arbitrary that. He doesn't specifically say, and when you look in the record, there is nothing.
Well, but you say there are no factual allegations in the petition? Why isn't it a factual allegation to say that someone on a daily basis has struck and assaulted the minor plaintiff with a school paddle, kept in the possession or subject to control of the defendant?
When you look at the two defendants, Ron Johnson and Chad Willier, who are before you, they don't allege that those individuals did any of those things. He's incorrect about his 1983 analysis using Doe versus Taylor.
What about the tardy freeze that they allege that Johnson engaged
in? The tardy freeze, the allegation of what he did does not violate a clearly established right. It is not a substantive due process violation.
Well, is it because the alleged conduct is not a violation, or are you saying that never under any circumstances could conduct associated with corporal punishment rise to the level of a substantive due process violation?
I believe it is possible for that to happen, certainly. And Doe versus Taylor, clearly, that was a sexual abuse case. And, of course, that rises to a substantive due process. I think if you were to go further and say that if they allege that the paddlings were not on the behind but on the head, then it's possible that that could have been
a
substantive.
That defendant Johnson implemented and enforced through himself and other school officials a policy whereby a multitude of children were subjected to mass beatings in the school cafeteria. What was the evidence on that point?
The evidence was that no plaintiff ever received any more than two swats of a paddle the entire time, and that the only alleged injury of all the plaintiffs is that one student said at some point he received a blister as a result of a paddling, but he didn't say that the paddling, and the record is clear on this, did not say that the paddling came from Ron Johnson or Chad Woolery. And I think it's so obvious on Chad Woolery. There's nothing in the record whatsoever that says Chad Woolery knew about it. In fact, the only thing in the record is, record page 129, an affidavit from Chad Woolery saying, I didn't know what was happening at Comstock. No one ever made me aware of it.
But Mr.
I never had it.
Again, I keep hearing you talk about whether or not on this summary judgment record, this punishment was reasonable or rises to the level of arbitrariness, which seems to me to go to the underlying merits of the 1983 crime. I'm just having a hard time connecting with you. I mean, it sounds like you're arguing whether or not they have developed sufficient facts to state a violation of the Constitution and bring it under 1983, as opposed to claiming immunity.
Your Honor, if we look at the
issue...
I'm
just not connecting with you. I want to make sure that... I just want to make sure you get the chance to explain so you can help me understand.
To look at whether or not there was a clearly established right at that time and whether they were entitled to immunity.
All right, but we agree. Do you disagree with the Dallas Court of Appeals when it says that there can be no substantive due process violation on a corporal punishment claim? Do you disagree with them?
I don't disagree as to whether or not at the time these two individuals, Chad Woolery and Ron Johnson, were acting, that there was a clearly established right that corporal punishment violated the Constitution.
Okay, so you disagree with the Dallas Court of Appeals then?
No, I think I'm saying I'm consistent with it, and maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
Well, do you agree or disagree with the Court of Appeals analysis violation of substantive due process, i.e. if there is an appropriate state remedy, a safeguard? Do you agree with that analysis?
I agree with that analysis, but I don't think that's what the Dallas Court of Appeals did. The
what
Dallas
did
Court
do?
Of Appeals goes through the entire explanation of Fee versus Herndon and saying how this is not a statement of a substantive due process violation, and then they add a sentence afterwards, and that sentence says, but the court then basically, in citing Fee versus Herndon, then went further and said that if you do name a substantive due process claim, we then look at whether or not there are adequate state remedies. But then they come back and say, nonetheless, we did not find a substantive due process claim in the first place. So they didn't get to the test. Clearly, we do have the adequate state remedies. But you got to get to that first test there. Now, if this were an issue of, you know, the Dallas Independent School District is up here, and you're deciding, do we want to say corporal punishment violates substantive due process? That might be a different story, but we're not. We're here on the two individuals and whether it was clearly established at the time. And it clearly isn't, because even today, There are students who are receiving licks in schools from corporal punishment, and we're not saying it's a constitutional violation. So how would they have known 5 years ago? And if you look at the other cases, Ingram versus Wright, 20 swats. No constitutional violation according to the Fifth Circuit. Substantive due process. You look at Cunningham versus Beavers, 5 swats of a paddle. No constitutional violation.
But no constitutional violation versus talking about immunity. Mitchell versus Forthaus says that whether the punishment involved is reasonable or rises to the level of arbitrariness are not questions involving federal immunity. They go to the merits of whether there's an actual violation. Do you disagree with that?
No, but I still think you have to look at Angel versus Fairfield, which says, and I still propose, that you're looking at conclusions.
Well, let's assume everything you say. It would seem to me that whether or not Johnson and Woolery committed the acts, did the physical hitting of the children, or whether or not they condoned the physical hitting of the children, is a merits question. It's not an immunity question. The immunity question is, was whatever happened a deprivation of constitutional right? Ms. Mulberg says, if that's the question, then all the pleading has to say is that an act violating a significant of a constitutional right occurred, and he gets past immunity. Your argument seems to be that, well, the facts don't rise to the level of deprivation, which may be the case. So let's look at this summary judgment. You come in and say they have not pierced immunity, to use that word, because they don't show that the punishment that occurred rises to the level of a deprivation of a constitutional right. It seems to me in that posture then, the court has to determine the facts. You say that other case said you've got to allege facts. Well, let's not talk about facts. We're already in summary judgment posture. So on behalf of his client, Mr. Mulberg comes back with a response to the summary judgment, either in the response or by affidavit, pointing out the punishment that was imposed. The court, it seems to me, has a decision there. And the decision is either that punishment doesn't rise to the level of deprivation, therefore immunity is not pierced, and therefore judgment, or it says the punishment that was imposed based on this record does rise to the level of constitutional deprivation, in which event immunity is pierced, and now we go to the other questions. Did Woolery do it? Did Woolery know about it? Did Johnson do it? Did Johnson? You go to those other questions at the other end. It seems to me the posture of this case simply is the merits of whether immunity has been pierced. Either it has been pierced or it hasn't been pierced. And so what is the evidence of punishment that's in the record, in this summary judgment record, that occurred?
Okay, and I agree with you. It is the first, and that is what the Dallas Court of Appeals held. The evidence here before you is that students received no more than 2 swats, and the only claim of any injury whatsoever was one student claimed at one point he received a blister. That's the entire injury. That's the entire record of how many, the maximum number of swats any single plaintiff received.
And if we conclude as a matter of law that that is not unconstitutional punishment, what is the next step we go to?
I think that with respect to the federal, well, the next step I say is 101-106, because that's the next part of the argument. But I think that you're done with it.
If we reach that conclusion, immunity has not been pierced?
Yes, Your Honor. And then we move on.
Well, if we can, if it's not too premature, I would like to take that next step. Because that's where I have the biggest problem. If we assume that this is not unconstitutional corporal punishment as a matter of law, you say we get into what, Chapter 101 of the Civil Practice Remedies Code?
You could.
Or where do you say we go?
Well, there's 22051, of course, of the education code
right.
for the individuals. There is, I mean, that's the most obvious.
Okay, well, that was my concern because it seemed like we had ships passing in the night. It seems like, based upon the allegations we have in this case, you don't go under the Tort Claims Act, you go solely under the Education Code.
Well, you could try to go under the Tort Claims Act, but as we know from the second part of this case, you can't. That's right. You go under 2205.
Okay.
If I may turn to the second issue, which is 101-106, that's before you, I think that case is already, if there's anything that's clearly established, 101-106 should be. This court has already held in Thomas versus Oldham that what the Dallas Court of Appeals basically did is wrong.
Well, let's take a step back. How do you get there? Don't you agree that that applies only to claims brought under the Tort Claims Act?
101-106 says if the claim against the government is brought under the Tort Claims Act. That's correct. If that is, and there is a judgment against or for the government, from that time on there is a bar against the employees, or as this court said in Newman versus Oversteller, an immunity, an unequivocal granting of immunity. All right. So, if your question is, was the original case brought under, against the government, under the Tort Claims Act, it had to be. Urban versus Canada says it had to be. And in essence, Newman versus Oversteller, although it doesn't address it, indicates it had to be.
Wait a second. Doesn't 101-106, what you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Doesn't it read, quote, a judgment in an action for a settlement of a claim under this chapter bars any action involving the same subject matter by the claimant against the employee of a governmental unit, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes.
Has the words under this chapter?
Yes.
It says a judgment in an action or settlement of a claim under this chapter. We don't have a judgment or settlement of a claim under this chapter.
Yes, actually you do, Your Honor. Okay. The question of 22051 refers to only the employees. Okay? So if your question is, how do you bring a cause of action against the government itself, the Dallas School District in this case, the only way you can ever bring a tort against the government, as we all acknowledge, is through the Tort Claims Act.
Okay, so, but you would agree, and I'm looking at it, I don't see anywhere where they brought a claim under the Tort Claims Act in their petition.
Doesn't 051 say, except this to motor vehicles, the chapter does not apply to a school district?
Yes, it does. And that's why we win. The fact is, plaintiffs bring suits against school districts all the time that are tort claims, and they get thrown out all the time. But the fact is, you can't plead out and say, oh no, we're saying common law, and that's what plaintiffs did. We're saying common law. Urban versus Canada specifically said that doesn't work. What happens if you bring a tort, it automatically comes under the Tort Claims Act. It's like an enabling act to bring causes for a tort claim. And then what happens is we turn to 051 and we say, nope, we're out, and it's over with. In Newman versus Oversteller, if you look at that case, what you all did was you took a case up that was intentional inflection of emotional distress. Clearly, another thing that was against a school district and that was immune from tort. But you said 101-106 could apply to the employees. So you've had this case before.
Well, is it your position that 106 applies here?
To the state claims, absolutely, for these two. It does, and the court was incorrect in ruling that it did not. Yeah, but there are two issues before you. The second one, what the Dallas Court of Appeals said was, wait a minute, there's still plenary power. It has to be a final judgment. The statute, 101-106, doesn't say anything about final. And we know the legislature is familiar with the term because in 101-108, they use the word final judgment.
Okay, I hate to be dense, but I want you to walk me through this one more time. 101-106 specifically says it applies only to claims brought under this chapter. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, would you agree also that they have not brought any claims under the Tort Claims Act?
No.
Okay, where in their petition do they bring a claim under the Tort Claims Act?
They claimed in their petition assault and battery against the Dallas Independent School District. That is a tort.
Do you recall in particular which paragraph or section?
I don't have their petition in front of me, but they alleged intentional infliction of emotional distress, assault and battery, all those things were against.
Well, here's what bothers me. I'm looking at it right now. Under the assault and battery section, it said, it's two sentences solely, and the last sentence says, the actions are actionable under common law and under the waiver of immunity found in the Texas Education Code.
Right.
Because they brought it under the education code, not under...
They brought it under common law also. And that's what happened in Irvin versus Canada. And clearly that must be what happened in Newman versus Oversteller. Anytime you bring any tort, it doesn't matter. Let's say you think it's coming under the education code. The only way you can bring a tort is under the Tort Claims Act against the government. And so, you can call it whatever you want, but it quacks like a duck, it comes under the Tort Claims Act.
Can't you bring it under the Education Code?
The Education Code isn't an enabling act.
What about the bus case, LaFleur, whatever it was called?
Lalo was the one exception under one, well, they thought it was, under 051, because they thought it was the use of a motor vehicle. So, you know, they brought it that way, but the court didn't look at 101 and 106 because apparently they never raised it as a defense. There's nothing in the record that shows they ever used that as a defense. The Dallas Court of Appeals tossed out our 101-106 argument for the reason that they said there's plenary power still, and because the judgment's not final. Clearly, that is not the same. I mean, what's different between Thomas versus Olin? Contemporaneous judgments, there's still plenary power for the trial court. If you accept the Dallas Court of Appeals reasoning in 101-106, Thomas versus Olin is wrong. And that is not the idea. The idea of 101-106 is that you have to make a choice. It is a choice statute. You want to go ahead and sue the school district? Go ahead. You want to sue the employee? Go ahead. If you're not sure what you want to do, sue them both, do some discovery, and at some point, if there is a judgment for the government, according to 101-106, can I finish my thought?
Finish the sentence.
Thank you. At some point under 101-106, when there's a judgment, the decision's made for you. You are stuck with the government, whether it's for or against the government. You are stuck, and all the employees are entitled to that immunity from that time on.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, and I do want to address the Tort Claims Act because I don't feel that was completely addressed. But I'll be brief, Justice Hankinson, to answer your question. This was an immunity matter, otherwise we could not be here. Now, the Tort Claims and two SWATs, I think that is stretching the evidence to some extent, to the extent that any evidence is in the record. Maybe two SWATs every day times so many days, whatever. And to address your point, Your Honor, when I left the eighth grade, they actually gave me the patent as an award. The Tort Claims Act doesn't belong in this case for a very simple reason. The Tort Claims Act says it doesn't belong in this case.
Where is that?
051. I don't see anything in the pleadings that say that our children were beaten with a motor vehicle. And it is very precise that it says...
Where else do you look for a waiver of immunity then if you have to sue a school district?
The education code. Oh, a waiver of immunity?
Yes, a waiver of immunity.
Frankly, you probably don't have it, but let me concoct or tell you where you could have it.
Don't you have to have it to be able to sue the school district? Is it a subdivision of the state?
Yes and no, because we know immunity is in two prongs. Y'all have just decided the Jones case, I believe, in December, talking about the jurisdictional aspect where there is immunity from suit. In the defensive aspect of the second prong where there is immunity from liability. So if you look at all these creatures in state government, like school districts, let's take Dallas Area Rapid Transit or even the Austin Metro system. What you typically find is, if anybody ever looks at it, a waiver of immunity from suit, because you have in virtually every one of them the provision that this entity is subject to sue, being sued.
Where's the
and
statute
suing.
That says that?
I'm giving an example. I don't know if it does. I think there are school district language like that, but this is just an example. So, to answer this question, you certainly could in a context where that language was there.
But you didn't allege that.
No, we didn't allege that. then your defense of immunity, your immunity issue becomes one of affirmative defense.
But you got to have a threshold. Where do you have the authority to get in the courthouse door against the Dallas Independent School District unless it's under the Tort Claims Act?
Well, the Tort Claims Act doesn't create the cause of action.
But it only weighs immunity with respect to certain things. And unless you can fit yourself in those things, doesn't DSID have
That I don't know, Your Honor. Let me be quite frank with the court because it was
the Tort Claims Act applies to school districts. It is defined as a governmental entity in the Tort Claims Act. And the Education Code limits the applicability of other provisions. But the only waiver of immunity as to school districts in Texas law is the waiver under the Tort Claims Act for the operation of motor vehicles. Isn't that correct?
That is correct,
okay,
as far
so
as I know.
The only place we have a waiver of immunity after school districts is in the Tort Claims Act for operating under it.
That's the only one I know of.
So if you can't fit yourself in one of the exceptions of the Tort Claims Act, there is no waiver of immunity as to the Dallas Independent School District.
There very well may not be. And let me tell you why that is more important now than it was, because if y'all just had the opportunity to reverse, I forget which court of that Jones case. There were many of us out there who thought that immunity was not a jurisdictional matter to begin with, and that it was simply an affirmative defensive matter in both contexts, to suit and to liability. You make it clear now, as of 2 months ago, that they're not equivalent.
So when a trial court renders a judgment for the school district, saying the school district is immune, doesn't that kick in the immunity for employees as well?
No, because that only applies to where the Texas Tort Claims Act applies. And 101.106 says it applies to claims arising under this chapter. I may not have quoted it exactly. This claim could not possibly have arisen in this chapter. You would have to rewrite the law decision, frankly, to get there. But it goes even further in the case of the school district. It says not only does it not apply, not only does it apply to certain situations in the school districts, the waiver of immunity applies only in case of motor vehicles. So
isn't your argument it limits the applicability of the Tort Claims Act even further as to school districts than as to other government
entities? Yes, and I think there's one other in that same category that I don't recall what you would call it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.